Kalka yanked his spear from where it was still strapped against his back and rammed it as hard as he could into its wide open mouth. Jerking the spear back, the Whippet glanced in the opposite direction. "Where are you going?" the droid asked.
"Back to my ship."
Tulka was already halfway across the floor. He turned and looked back at the droid.
"You staying here?"
"Here? With them?" The HK didn't hesitate. It followed the Whippet down through the simulation chamber, out of the pain pipe, and into the snow. Chapter 35, The Anatomy Lessons. "It's cold," Mag said, shivering and looking around as if for verification from the others. "Feels good, though, doesn't it, after all that?" Kindra didn't say anything. They had just stepped out of the tunnel, she and Mags and Hartwig, with Master Harakan silently bringing up the rear. Hartwig had taken Rat's lightsaber, scrubbing the handle with the first handful of snow he could scoop up. But no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't get the stain to go away. "Are we going to talk about what happened back there?" Mags asked. "What?" Kindra said. "You have something you need to say?" They all turned around to look at Hartwig, standing several meters behind them, still inside the tunnel so that half his face remained in darkness. "With Rat," Mags said. "He..." "Rat got turned," Hartwig said, emerging into the vague gray glow of the twilight air, breath pluming from his lips. It was the first time he'd spoken since they'd chopped their way through the barrier, and his voice sounded different, thick and strange. "He changed into one of them, and Master Harakan boxed him, and I got his lightsaber. End of story." "What about us?" Mags asked. "None of us was bitten, as far as I can tell." Hartwig looked around as if waiting to see if the others would contradict him. "You okay?" Mags nodded. "Kindra, you have something you need to come clean about?" She didn't look around. "Kindra!" Silence. "Hey." Hartwig walked over, pushing past Mags, and grabbed her shoulder, swinging her hard toward him. "I'm talking to you." Kindra snapped around on him, her eyes brittle pellets. "I'm clean."
"You're sure?"
Hartwig hadn't lowered his hands.
"What's that on your neck?"
"Very funny."
"You think I'm joking?"
He waited while Kindra reached up and touched her throat, perhaps a centimeter lateral to the jugular. She winced at the open wound, drew back her hand, and looked at the scarlet stain on her index finger. Standing apart from them, a little distance away, Master Harakan watched without saying anything. "Just a cut," she said. "A piece of the electrical fixture."
"You don't know that," Hartwig said.
"You don't think I'd remember being bitten?" "I think," he held her gaze, "that there was a lot of infected blood flying around. And if some of it splashed in there..." "Then I'd already be screaming and ripping your guts out," Kindra snapped, "which I'm not, no matter how much I'd like to. So if you're done casting baseless aspersions..." "You were ready to kill me back there over a lightsaber," Hartwig said. "Seems to me that it's in the group's best interest if we took you out of the equation now." He glanced at the Sith Master. "Right, Master Harakan?" Harakan didn't have a chance to reply before Kindra cut in again. "Is this really what you want?" she asked Hartwig, blade ready. "We've sparred enough times in the training arena. You know how it's going to go down." Hartwig didn't answer, just stared at her, shoulders rising and falling with every breath, his face betraying no trace of emotion. The wind flung another thin gust of snow between them, and Kendra felt the cut beginning to ache on her throat. "Make a move," she said.
"You first."
"Wait," Mag said. "Nobody knows what the incubation period for this thing is, right?" Hartwig didn't take his eyes off Kindra.
"Seemed pretty fast with Ra'at."
"Yeah, but Ra'at got tagged firsthand. Maybe accidental exposure takes longer." Kindra could hear Mag's voice growing more confident as he spoke, warming to his own argument. "Point is, we don't know.
So before somebody does something stupid, how about we all take a step back, strip down, and make sure nobody's got any open cuts that could have gotten contaminated blood in them? He looked back at Combat Master Harakan, who still had not spoken. What do you think? Harakan nodded. Yes, he said. Strip down? Kendra's expression had already gone from bellicose to incredulous. You're asking me to take my clothes off. It's the only way to be sure. He glanced at Hartwig. You agree to that? Why not? Hartwig shrugged. I've got nothing to hide. He yanked off his tunic and the uniform shirt beneath it, then shoved his pants down to his ankles. In front of him, Kendra had already slipped out of her coat, keeping her bare arms crossed over her chest, gazing back defiantly at the others. That's as far as I'm going. Hartwig rolled his eyes and turned back to Mags, who stood shivering in his shorts and boots, clutching a wad of balled-up clothes against him like a small child that had gone to sleep. Behind him, bare-chested, stood Master Harakan. The combat master had also stripped to the waist, without being asked, revealing a broad, well-muscled physique hardened by scar tissue, strange tattoos, and decades of intense physical conditioning. His head was bowed as if he was inspecting something in the snow. Looks like we're all clean, Hartwig said. So I guess that means we... Master Harakan raised his head. The crooked slash of his grin on his face seemed to cut almost diagonally across the entire width of his head. Blood had already started streaming down on either side of his mouth where he'd gnawed his own lips open. There was nothing human in his eyes. With a shapeless noise that was half shout, half gasp, Hartwig fumbled for his lightsaber and dropped it in the snow. He bent down, scrambling to pick it up, but succeeded only in pushing it deeper. In less than a second, Harakan was on him. He grabbed Hartwig's head and buried his teeth in the student's throat, ripping out a mouthful of tissue and cartilage. Kendra watched wild, looping parabolas of blood spurting high in the air around him, like a miniature fountain that had been turned on directly beneath Hartwig's chin. Hartwig staggered backward, hands up, blinking at the Sith Master as he whipped around to face him. His nerves were gone. Harakan's hands flew up, preparing to fire off a burst of force lightning, when its head toppled sideways off its shoulders and rolled, still spurting, into the dark snowdrifts. Harakan's decapitated body collapsed, seizing and twitching, and Mag saw Kendra standing behind it. She gripped the lightsaber in both hands with absolute steadiness. Thanks, Mags breathed. Forget it. She walked over to Harakan's still snarling head and chopped it straight down the middle. That one's all yours. Mags looked back around at Hartwig's corpse. Its ripped open throat spilled out sloppily across the snow like a losing hand of Pazak. The thing was already starting to come back. It was squirming in place, shifting its arms and legs, preparing to sit up again. Listless bubbling and gurgling sounds issued from the hole in its neck. You gonna take care of that? Kendra asked. Mags took a breath and swung his own lightsaber down on Hartwig's corpse, carving its torso open from throat to groin. Gazing down at him, Kendra realized she could see the black, still pulsing gristle of the thing's dead heart laboring stupidly onward, gasping for one more beat. What she felt more than anything at that moment was revulsion at the human machine's mindless commitment to endure and endure and endure. Is it down? She asked. Mags didn't answer. Is it down? Mags went to work with the lightsaber again, and this time it took the Hartwig thing's head off at the shoulders. The head dangled for a moment on one remaining ribbon of flesh, then dropped away. A few listless dribbles of boiled blood leaked like tears from the sheared-off arteries, black as used oil, before they cauterized completely. Now it's down, he said. Kendra nodded but kept her own lightsaber drawn. What now? Mags asked. I'm leaving, she said. You're staying here. Mags blinked. What? Kendra's lightsaber slashed out from the back, catching him across the hamstrings, shearing through tendons just above the ankle. Mags shrieked and slipped, arms pinwheeling, all balance gone. He was screaming at her, asking her why she did it. What did she think she was doing? But by that time, Kindra had already turned and started running. Not walking, but running as fast as she could in the opposite direction. Wait! Mag sat up and tried to stand, but his lower legs refused the job, the severed Achilles tendons dumping him forward again into the snow. When he lifted his head up, he heard the noises coming up from behind him. No, Mag thought. No, this was all a mistake. Just a big mistake. He looked back, and they fell on him. Chapter 36. Dreer. After 20 minutes of wandering through the library, Zoe had to admit that she was utterly lost. At first, the voice of the orchid had drawn her onward as she'd entered the high doorway and followed the main concourse through room after room, some with ceilings so high that she couldn't see them, others so cramped that she had to bend down just to pass through. Irregularity was the only design here, symmetry fractured by age and weather. With every step, the subterranean air had grown steadily colder, and Zoe was acutely aware of traveling not just forward, but downward, as though the library's depths sank without boundary into the very core of the planet. She could feel the air in her lungs and taste the oxidized flavor of metal shavings. The only remaining light came from the torches and lamps mounted high overhead. The only sound was the crunch of her footsteps. Even at these depths, snow had found its way inevitably through the cracks and broken places, stirring wraith-like and restless in the low whine of the wind. When she looked back, she saw her footprints leading down the hallway, one lonely set of tracks gleaming in the torchlight. Who lit these torches, she wondered, and who kept them burning? Tulka had refused to follow her here, leaving her to go alone. When she'd confronted him about it and said, "Let me get this straight. You'll walk into a Sith Lord's tower, but you won't go into a library." He'd merely nodded and planted his feet, telling her that he knew a trap when he saw one. Zoe had protested. She knew the sound of the orchid's voice calling to her. But now she was beginning to wonder if he was right to stay away. The orchid would never deliberately put you in danger. You know that. Yes, she did. And yet, up ahead, a vast cathedral-ceilinged room spread open, flickering in the light of a few sparsely placed torches. Faintly, she thought she smelled smoke and burning flimsyplast. She looked right and left, allowing her attention to be drawn upward and upward farther, straining to encompass the shelves and their apparently endless holdings. Another gust of wind whipped through the open space, stirring the old, dry snow that lay here and there in random accumulations along the tiled floor. Zoe paused. She hadn't heard the voice of the orchid in several minutes. Not for the first time, she wondered if she could find her way back if she had to. She supposed that she might be able to follow her own tracks back out if the draft from the cracks in the walls hadn't already smoothed them away. There were plenty of hiding places here if she ran into trouble, but what if the trouble was waiting for her in one of them? Something touched her face, cold and knowing. Zoe froze and held her breath, staring into the empty space immediately in front of her nose. There was nothing visible there, yet she felt its presence, an unseen leather-gloved hand stroking her cheek, running over the length of her jaw and down to her throat, searching out her soft areas with the intimacy of a lover. Her chest squeezed and clamped shut over the skittish tremolo of her pulse. A noise behind her scraped through the silence, very close. Zoe whipped around and looked back up the way she'd come. Her tracks were still there, leading away into the distant edge of vision. And now she saw them. A second set of tracks, running parallel to hers. The print stopped, perhaps 10 meters away, and cut sideways, disappearing behind a sagging half-wall, its dimensions buried in shadow. Within its depths, something was standing, watching her. Zoe felt the weight of its presence settling over her, anchoring her to the spot. Tensing to run, she saw Scabrous step out from behind the wall and into the half-light, so that almost exactly half his face was illuminated. Zoe glimpsed the gem-edged hardness in his eye. His face was a mottled quilt of gray flesh and exposed muscle, and the clinched grin on his face was somewhere between madness and rigor mortis. He'd been infected, she realized. Yet somehow he'd managed to stave off full transformation, at least temporarily. Her gaze fell to the pack of medical equipment, monitors, tubing, and depleted reservoirs of blood that dangled from the angular arch of his shoulders. This new version of him looked gaunter but somehow more imposing, as if the bones inside his body had swollen and remade him from the inside out. "Hestizo Trace," he said, extending one hand. "It's good to see you again. I hope you won't bother trying to run." She opened her mouth to speak and realized she couldn't breathe. Scabrous gestured with one hand, and she felt herself yanked forward, down the corridor and into his grasp. Within seconds, she was so close to him that she had to look up to see his face. "This library," he said, "is the oldest part of the academy, older even than the tower itself. It was constructed over 1,000 years ago by a Sith Lord named Darth Dreer. He founded the academy back when the planet itself was young. The ancient writings tell about how he used his first students as laborers. For hundreds of years, the masters at this academy believed that a good many of those students died down in these very chambers, using the Force to move hundreds of tons of snow and ice and dig out these corridors and chambers to house Dreer's vast collection of specimens. It was thought that Dreer worked the students until they died from exhaustion." He smiled without the slightest gleam of humor. "The true genius of the structure lies beneath it. Under these floors, Dreer built himself a secret temple where he practiced the rituals and rites of the ancients, encoded in the Sith holocron." Zoe's lungs began to unlock enough for her to sip in a small breath. "Grow," she called out to the orchid. "Oh, please, if you're there at all, grow, grow in him, grow now." But there was nothing. "When I first discovered the holocron," Scabrous said, "I did not fully understand its protocols." He gestured to his face at the horror of its ongoing decay. "But I understand them now." "What do you want from me?" Zoe asked. "Ah." Scabrous's cheeks sucked in, and he licked his lips so that she could see the dead gray surface of his tongue like a lizard coiled against the yellow stones of his teeth. "Darth Dreer wrote that he had found an elixir for staving off death itself, the ingredients of which he recorded in the holocron, including, of course, your beloved orchid. The mixture was complete in and of itself, with a single flaw." He gestured at his own face. "The inevitable dissolution of the tissue. It struck immediately upon exposure, spreading first through the brain, where it drove the victim into a state of homicidal madness, and then through the rest of the body, shutting it down. The flesh would remain animate but insensate, living only to hunger, to feed and kill." "If you knew all that," Zoe asked, "why would you ever try to recreate the experiment yourself?" Scabrous's grin seemed to dangle from the sides of his face, a prehensile thing all its own. "Before he died, Darth Dreer wrote of the final stage of the process, the step that he himself was never able to achieve. he dispatched his sentries to a nearby planet to abduct a Jedi and bring him to the secret temple underneath the library. After ingesting the elixir, in the final hours before his body gave in completely, under exactly the right circumstances and conditions, Dreer planned to use a ceremonial Sith sword to cut open the Jedi's chest while he was still alive and eat his heart. Only then, with that final infusion of midi-chlorians still warm from the Jedi's blood, would the decay process be held back, granting the Sith Lord his ultimate immortality. Zoe stared at him. She couldn't move, couldn't breathe. Unfortunately, Scabros said, the sentries failed to bring back a Jedi with a suitable quantity of midichlorians in his bloodstream before Dreer's disease overtook him. But tonight, with your assistance, I am in the unique position of being able to fulfill that destiny personally. Zoe felt something curl around her arms, snapping them back with a sharp jerk and forcing her shoulder blades back. Thick green vines had looped over her elbows and squirmed up her sides. She craned her neck to the right, and when she looked around, she saw them. The dead ones. The corpses that she had faced on the rocky overhang outside the tower. Their heads were still gone, blown off their shoulders. Instead, the riot of catastrophic vegetation that she had coaxed from inside their skulls had grown more profuse since she'd seen them last, grown with utter abandon. These were the runners and vines that had ensnared her now, stretching from the stumps of their necks dozens of slick green ropes gripping her arms and holding her fast. As Zoe stared at them, she saw, to her immeasurable horror, that the stems were topped with dozens of tiny black orchids budding everywhere. In her mind, she could hear the flowers hissing and shrieking, crackling hysterically, hungrily, insanely. They pricked her arms like thirsty syringes, questing after her blood. No, she thought. No, no, please. You grew them, Scabrous said. How lovely that they recognize you. The headless, vine-stricken corpses pushed in closer, groping and shoving until Zoe realized that she could smell them. They stank like a freshly disinterred grave, full of black dirt and mold and rotten meat. She felt their cold skin pushing against her even as the vines constricted tighter around her arms, squeezing, twisting, pinching her skin. Scabrous stepped forward, shoulders rising up until he towered over the things. His mouth opened wide, and he screamed. His breath was fetid, the breath of a thing that had already died and was decaying from the inside out. Zoe felt the things responding immediately to the scream, recoiling, pulling her back with them. And when they screamed their response, it was a terrible, throatless noise that came throbbing up from their severed necks, vibrating up and out of the stalks, one solid blast of high-pitched sound that rose, shifted frequency, and dropped again, a message composed entirely of high-pitched, almost ultrasonic oscillation. They swung her around. In an act of pure desperation, some part of her must have already known she would fail. Zoe tried to use the force on them, tried to reach out and connect with the plant presence inside them. At the instant she made contact, a sharp jolt of toxic energy crackled through her, slamming through her brain like an ice axe and making her cry out loud. The inner landscape of her eyelids swirled with sear colors, shades of burnt bronze and anemic yellow. The vines were dragging her down the corridor of the library, across the cold floor. Zoe's eyes widened. Up ahead, a great rectilinear hole gaped open in the floor to reveal a shadowy pit whose depths seemed bottomless, even from here. Yet there were strange lights below, shimmering from deep within. And she knew where she was going. Under these floors, Dreer built himself a secret temple. where he practiced the rituals and rites of the ancients. Scabrous gestured, and they pulled her down. Chapter 37. Some Kind of Nature. Trace crossed a long, desolate stretch of nothingness between two high, featureless walls. The night storm barreling down over him like a demon with a debt to collect. Up ahead, still perhaps 100 meters in the distance, stood the tower. He was almost there. Despite his urgency, he knew he had to move more carefully now. Since the death of the Sith Blademaster, he'd seen no more of the things like the one inside the wall, but he'd known they were there. Extrasensory perception, telemetric ability, was no longer necessary. He could hear them screaming. And the screaming got louder the closer he came to the tower, more intense somehow, and hungrier. He had never seen anything like the abomination that had ripped the Blademaster apart. A living corpse. A dead thing whose flesh and muscle still moved, even as it decayed before his eyes. He sensed their presence around him, below and behind the unseen temples and stone outbuildings. Could a lightsaber dispatch a creature like that? Or would it merely tear it into individual pieces that would, in turn, continue to pursue their prey? And what about Hestizo? Had the things found her as well? He stopped again, stretching out with his feelings, the Force casting a wide psychic net in search of any sign of his sister, but it retrieved nothing. He still believed that she was here, perhaps in the tower, perhaps not. But the silence within him was far more disturbing than the screaming in the distance. Keep going. You will find her. You will. For another 10 minutes, he scrambled forward. He took another step and faltered again, raising his head slightly, sniffing the air. He smelled smoke. Clambering to the top of a broken pillar, he looked in every direction until a glint of firelight in the distance caught his eye. A flickering orange glow inside a vast half-sunken stone structure, perhaps a quarter kilometer away. Trace watched it for a moment. He wanted to be sure. By itself, a fire would have meant nothing, especially on a planet of ruins where the Sith ruled and the dead had been restored to life. But he also suddenly felt his sister's presence inside. She's in there. She is. Leaping down off the broken pillar, Rojo Trace began to run. 20 seconds, the time it took him to reach the entryway, shoving his way through, unmindful of the darkness, the snow and clutter, and the thickening stink of smoke. Loose objects lay strewn randomly around the floor, books, scrolls, unidentifiable debris. Rows of low stone tables like marble slabs. It was some type of vast library. He kept going. Hestizo, it's me. Are you there? It's Rojo. I'm coming. An arm hooked him from behind, lurching him upward.
Have a care, Jedi.
An ancient voice, it croaked in front of him. Each word came out deliberately as a glottal, sawdusty reverberation that seemed to move the air molecules themselves.
You seem to have forced your way into my sanctum sanctorum. Perhaps a modicum of restraint is in order.
Trace felt himself being swung up into the air and realized that he was hanging from the limbs of an immense tree. Looking down, far down, he saw the warty knuckles of its roots plunged deep into the floor itself, causing its variegated tiles to buckle and bulge. The thing's trunk rose upward to spread dozens of sinuous gray limbs throughout the cavernous and gloomy room around it. Its upper branches clutched his wrist tighter than ever, swinging him around. And Trace observed that the walls around him were lined floor to ceiling with shelves of hollow books, scrolls and grimoires, and various cluttered arcana crammed back in every available notch and crevice.
This is my dwelling place, Jace.
The tree creature's voice burbled up from somewhere inside its trunk.
And you have intruded here.
Trace's hand eased back for his lightsaber. There was a sharp whip crack and a sting as one of the branches slapped it aside, and Trace saw the lightsaber go pinwheeling away. It landed below the shelves in the corner by the outer edge of a glimmering hearth, where the orange coals of a fire seethed and flickered.
No need for your weapon here, the voice said. Not in this place of learning. We are both learned beings, are we not? Enlightened and informed by the written word? No need for the encumbrances of physical violence.
It uttered another bulky, dusty chuckle.
Look upon me, if you like. Seek my face.
Trace smelled a tangy, musty odor pass beneath his nose, and turned to see the librarian's enormous wooden head craning toward him between its barren branches. It was a Netty, he realized, and it was sick. Whatever contagion had infected this planet had spread to it as well. Along its backside, the plant creature's once majestic form had taken on an altogether different cast. The formidable branches hung like clumps of atrophied muscle. Clusters of open sores had devoured the bark, and the exposed heartwood oozed a steady trickle of dark leakage that had collected on the floor around its roots. Whole shoals of hollow books and Sith texts floated like skiffs in the sprawling puddle of fluid. Whatever had befallen the Sith students here, it had jumped across species without losing any of its virulence. I'm looking for a Jedi named Hestizo Trace. The Netty didn't respond right away, except to shift his branches. Trace saw now that the creature's limbs were loaded with mountains of hollow books. Hundreds of them. Some piled so high that whole avalanches went spilling in one direction or another whenever he moved.
Of course I know about her, the Netty replied. You are her brother, Jace.
The branches trembled and more books fell.
Alas, she is lost.
Trace felt a sudden chill run through him, as if he'd just been poisoned and was only now beginning to realize it.
How do you know? What does it matter? Through the bond of leaf and vine.
A faint pause.
I summoned her here at the request of Lord Scabrous, and he killed her.
You're lying.
Am I now?
The withered face didn't seem overly offended by the accusation. If anything, it looked intrigued.
You don't sound so sure of yourself, Jedi. Not so sure at all. I have lived for more than 1,000 years, and now I have come to glimpse my final hours. Perhaps before I pass into the next stage of my evolutionary development, you would like to peer inside my mind and see whether or not I'm telling the truth?
Trace started to say something, but his voice broke off. The branch around his wrist clasped harder, turning him idly around, gouging into the bone. Archaic limbs rustled behind him, and he smelled a different odor coming out of them now, something far worse than the thing's breath. It was the enormous, boggy stench of the disease, something deeply and profoundly wrong.
Go on, the Netty said.
It sounded almost giddy now.
Look into my mind, Jedi. See what awaits you there. Seek my face.
Trace felt something encircle his right leg at the ankle and pull tight. Even as the branch tugged harder at his wrist, exerting a steadily increasing tension.
Seek my face.
The Neti repeated itself, foregoing speech entirely now, shouting the words directly into Trace's mind.
Seek my face.
Helpless, Trace felt himself sucked into the mire of the thing's thoughts. It was like plunging his hand into a vat of warm, black ooze. He groped for a moment in total blindness, trying to make some sense of the random shapes and impressions swimming around him in the Neti's palatial memory. And he saw. It was a different part of the Sith library, the hollow books and archives neatly arranged. Trace understood that he was seeing it through the Neti's eyes before it had gotten sick, and now he grasped the true dimensions of the librarian's collection. It didn't fill just this single room, but a series of other rooms winding off in manifold directions. For the millennium or more that the Neti had held court here as the Academy's librarian, it had been accumulating hollow books and charts, records and ephemera. Scouring the inner landscape for any sign of Hestizo, Trace's inner vision glided down one of these halls, moving as the Neti's limbs had moved, winding around a corner, beneath the shadowy recesses and through gigantic horseshoe archways. The architecture changed here, becoming less monastic and more ornate, resembling more of a battlement than a library. The winding incorporeal branches of the Neti's mind carried Trace deeper, past a recessed gallery, over a parapet, pausing here or there over endless accumulations of texts and writings.
This is my fortress, the voice inside him intoned. My bastion of knowledge acquired over the millennia. But now it is my fuel.
And always the echoing, mindless call for acknowledgement.
Do you see, Jedi? Do you understand, fuel?
And Trace felt himself nodding in perfect understanding. He did see. The Force help him. He did. Whether or not he had actually become the Neti in that moment, he wasn't sure. But their consciousness had melded, the two of them sharing a fundamental commonality that transcended simple thought and expression. He heard strange noises in his head, plosives and sibilants, making a somehow familiar name.
Dale Liss.
It was the librarian's name, Trace realized, his patronymic, and somehow knew that on his home planet it meant lover of knowledge, a perfect choice for... All at once, the quality of light changed. The memory grew brittle, harsher, more severe. An opening in the floor, a chasm of immeasurable depth leading down into silent gray volumes of cold subterranean space. Here, at the bottom, Trace saw a hooded silhouette standing in a dusty shaft of overhead light surrounded by piles of rubble. Part of the wall had collapsed or been torn away to reveal a hidden chamber inside it, a hidden Sith temple. The cloaked figure fell to his knees and knelt there, face hidden from view, galvanized by whatever he saw. Trace watched as the man reached in with both hands to take out a large gray case, ornately filigreed with hieroglyphs, glinting in the meager light. A moment of stillness shivered past. Then the figure turned the case on its side, smooth pink hands. They slid over it to find a recessed release switch and activated it. The box sprang open, and in that instant, Trace caught sight of a black pyramidal shape, its depthless surface reflecting back no light, only the pale face of the man gazing raptly into it. A Sith holocron, Trace thought. Here, in this library, this is where Darth Scabros found... The pyramid was vibrating ever so slightly, and Trace saw the man's reflection change as his lips moved, murmuring words he couldn't hear. The pyramid began to vibrate more steadily, practically purring in the man's fondling embrace. The image hit him head on, cannonballing him out of the Nettie's thoughts and back into the present moment with all the impact of unrestrained collision. His eyes throbbed in their sockets. Pain racked his chest, ribs, and pelvis until they felt as though they were being pried open by hooks. Somewhere amid the dying branches he could hear laughter, the mindless, jabbering laughter of the Nettie surrendering itself to madness. Smoke. I smell smoke. Trace fought to clear his mind. Heat. His skin blazed. Smoke assaulted his bronchial passageways, scorched the inner lining of his sinuses. The vision of what he'd seen in the temple pit was still glued to his consciousness, and he understood now that this was where the sickness had first originated. Its source had been the library in whose labyrinthine depths Darth Scabros had discovered a Sith holocron, forgotten perhaps for more than a millennium, and unleashed something that even he was unable to control. Trace felt the blood vessels in his head bulging with a sudden reversal of hydrostatic pressure. Wrenching agony took hold of his spine and hips. He looked down and saw that the Nettie's branches were squeezing him harder until his muscles howled for release. Behind the tree creature and below it, great ragged bursts of flame had started licking upward through the piles of fallen hollow books and sacred Sith texts, rising to engulf the library.
"Ought to have run away from here when you had the chance, Jedi."
The Nettie's branches, blazing now, swung across the shelves, knocking hundreds of hollow books into the fire.
"Ought never to have sought my face. I told you I had entered my final days here. Now we'll perish together. Jace. Wait, there is nothing left for me here. Nor you. We will go now, both of us, and join your sister, Jace. No."
But his limbs felt leaden, miserably weak, as if the smoke in his lungs had solidified, dropping massive hunks of ballast into his extremities. He had the awful suspicion that if he didn't start moving them soon, he'd never be able to move them again. Above him, the Nettie thing was having exactly the opposite reaction. Impending death had transformed it into a frantic, slashing version of itself. It flung its branches violently from side to side, twisting and heaving as if caught in a fiery hurricane, ripping its roots up from the floor. Somewhere in his own mind, Trace could feel the creature's last grasp on reality coming totally unmoored, even as it ripped itself from the floorboards. On either side, shelves were shuddering and collapsing with frightening speed, dumping their contents like squadrons of fiery angels falling into the abyss. The hollow books crackled, hissing showers of sparks as their circuitry burst apart in the widening blaze. How long did he have until the fire brought the roof itself down on top of them? 5 minutes? Less?
"Help me, please, help me, help me, help me."
He recoiled as if slapped. It was Zoe's voice, screaming through his mind. The thought went rocketing through him, snapping him back to a state of total awareness. Trace breathed, clear-headed, again, and grateful for it. The reprieve wouldn't last forever, wouldn't even last very long, he knew, but it might be enough to do what needed to be done. Closing his eyes, he let his body fall motionless in the grip of the Nettie's branches, surrendering all resistance. He took one last deep breath and held it. That single lungful of air would have to last him. or else his last hope of helping Zoe wouldn't amount to more than suicide. He created a small bubble, not much bigger than his own body, and sealed it shut, evacuating the air from inside it as he did so. The flames on his clothes, oxygen-starved, guttered, and died. Step one done. Now, get busy. Jolting himself free from the Nettie's branches, he lurched forward inside the bubble as hard as he could, his momentum knocking it loose and letting it fall down into the landscape of the library's floor. The bubble spun and slammed into the heaps of burning hollow books, pitching him sideways inside it as it continued to spin. The library reeled around him. Then, next to the Nettie's trunk, he saw his lightsaber. It lay among the creature's winding snake-like roots, in front of a large, ragged knothole that had already started charring black. Steadying himself inside the bubble, Trace placed both hands along the inner curvature of its surface, spread out his fingers, and waited. A burning branch, as big as his body, swung down from high above, crashing off the top of the bubble. The Nettie's twig fingers clutched rigidly as they twisted and burned in front of him. Trace almost breathed in and caught himself. His body ached for oxygen, for even an ounce of fresh air. But he knew that if he dissolved the barrier now and tried to inhale, the surrounding heat would flash fry him in seconds, starting with the lining of his lungs. He looked at the lightsaber, laboring to evacuate every other thought from his mind. At the Jedi Temple, they had taught that it was never a matter of manipulating the object, but of eliminating the space that separated you from it. Yet at this moment, the object in question had never felt so far away. To me, to me. The lightsaber remained where it was. Closing his eyes, he felt the bubble shift forward like a reluctant animal roused from hibernation and begin rolling over the mountains of burning books toward the Nettie's scorched trunk. When he opened his eyes, the lightsaber lay right in front of him, poised near the ragged knothole less than a meter away. Trace centered himself, drawing up his composure. The timing of what happened next was critical. Deactivating the bubble, he opened his hand, and the lightsaber flew into it. Its handle was almost too hot to hold, but the solidity of it had never felt better in his life. It didn't take long to find what he was looking for. His eyes followed the thing's trunk back down to where it met the floor. It had yanked its roots almost entirely out of the structure's foundation, and its balance now hung on by the slenderest of threads. Trace waited until the creature was about to fling itself forward again. Then he swung the lightsaber's blade in a single crosswise motion, slashing the remaining roots to the quick. The Nettie thing pitched forward, no longer even remotely anchored to the library's floor. It swung loose and kept falling, a captive of its momentum. It hit the floor hard enough to thrum the entire structure on its foundation, throwing up whole blinding swarms of sparks and ash in its wake. Trace staggered forward, waving away the smoke in front of his eyes. From here, he saw a gaping hole that the tree had torn through the library's outer wall, and through it, the frozen surface of Odacer Faustin's snow-covered landscape. He could already hear the hiss of steam as the flaming architecture met the sub-zero air outside. "Help me!" Trace felt his sister's scream go burning throughout his entire body. This wasn't just an impression, some random emotional flash. He actually felt her pain as it wrenched through his right arm, throbbing into his shoulder and chest, blasting up to the roots of his teeth. Tears boiled up in his eyes, and the wind whipped them away. His legs went numb, and he stumbled, almost falling over in the snow. He shook it off. He couldn't explain what he just experienced. It was as if everything he knew about his sister and the Force itself had suddenly been inverted, corrupted on some fundamental level. All that remained now was a sense of evil so intimate, so profoundly personal, that it made him want to crawl out of his own skin and leave it lying here like a heap of soiled clothes. She was close. So close. He took a step back toward the burning hall of the library. Snow was blowing in furiously now, swirling with smoke and ash as he staggered through the ruined stones. If he had to go back into the fire for her, then so be it. If he had to give his life... A blood-stained arm burst up from the rubble underneath him and seized him around the ankle, pulling him down. Then a second and a third. One of them hooked around his right wrist, the others around his waist. Two others punched upward, clamped down over either leg. Claw-like fingers plunged into one corner of his mouth and drew it back into a hideous, involuntary half-grin. The debris around him was roiling with activity now, of half-buried shapes clawing their way upward from below. They were covered in vines. Gravity took him, and he fell. Chapter 38. Cold Caller. Although he'd never considered himself a lucky man under the best of circumstances, Purgis Froude had had the presence of mind over the past several hours to realize that he was very fortunate indeed. The cargo hold of Dranach's cruiser, where he was hiding, had obviously been built to smuggle contraband. All around him in the half-light, empty swing bins and hidden storage spaces stood open, exhaling the damp and fragrant residue of illegally transported spices that had been piled up here over the years. Froude squirmed a little, lifting his head, stretching his legs and back, allowing himself to straighten up just enough to restore circulation to his extremities. There was tingling through his feet and toes, pins and needles as the leaden heaviness of numb muscle tissue began, reluctantly, to reawaken. He was going to need the full use of his feet, he knew, in case he had to run again. He hoped it wouldn't come to that. He'd run enough tonight already, although it certainly did beat the alternative. It had started hours ago. How many? He wasn't even sure now. He'd just finished removing the flight computer from Dranach's ship and had hauled it back into the shop to run some basic diagnostics on it. All that time, his unconscious mind had been wrangling with the issue of how he was going to handle the incoming heat signature from the unknown vessel heading straight for Odacer Faustin's landing hangar. To inform Darth Scabrous, or not inform him? That had been the question he'd been pondering when a bloody palm had slapped and squeaked off the control booth's glass. Jarred out of his thoughts, Froude had sat up and spun around just in time to see something, it might once have been human, in the process of ripping the hatch off the booth. That face was like something out of a nightmare. A gray and grinning mask. Whole chunks of viscera had begun to pucker and peel around its lips. Staring at it, Froude's brain had flashed back to a corpse that he and another mechanic had once stumbled across inside the cockpit of a speeder they'd been salvaging. Except this corpse's eyes were wide open and staring at him hungrily. If he'd stopped and given it even an instant's thought, Froude would already have been dead. Luckily for him, rumination was not his natural tendency. His first reaction was to run. He got one leg free and kicked out the front plate above the booth's instrument panel. The plexi popped loose, and he'd gone slithering out, hitting the hangar bay and running faster than he'd ever run in his life. The hangar was largely empty and presented extremely limited possibilities for protection. Acting on his gut, he'd reared around toward the nearest vessel, the cruiser that those two doomed bounty hunters, Dranach and Scarl, had arrived in, and went bolting up the still-extended landing ramp, reeling around to slam the ship's hatch shut behind him. Froude had piloted his share of ships before becoming a mechanic, and this one looked like as good an escape vehicle as any. Whatever the thing was that had tried to attack him, he had no intention of sticking around to fight it. No job was worth that. He'd started to power up the ship, ready to activate the flight computer, and realized his error. The hole in the instrumentation panel gaped at him like a slack, empty mouth. No, he thought, remembering the components that he'd yanked out with such enthusiasm just an hour or so before. The flight computer was still sitting on the counter in his booth, and he couldn't fly without it, any more than he could... The thing landed on the cockpit in front of him, grinning hideously, and began pounding and scratching at the trans-peristeel. Frode screamed. He couldn't help it. He didn't think he'd ever screamed that loud in his life. Certainly not in his adult life. But terror was booming through him now, in big, wide, frantic waves. He felt dizzy with it. And then he saw something worse. Outside, the hangar bay was filling with the living dead. Sith students, Frode realized only now how much he truly hated them, were shambling in the direction of the ship from all sides, jerking and scrambling and lurching forward, their mouths scooped open in big shovel-faced grins. Behind them, a sprawling, gangling thing that looked like a living tree was dragging a long mesh of dripping black roots and branches toward him. Its eyes reflected only madness. As Frode, who'd never once set foot in the Academy's library and would never have recognized the infected remains of its arboreal curator, stood crouched in the cockpit. One of the branch arms had swung up and slapped at the trans-peristeel viewport. It connected hard enough that for a second, he almost thought he'd heard the port crack. Impossible. But that was when he'd run back into the rear of the ship, down a landing ramp, through a hatch, until he'd landed here, in the safest place that he could find, the smuggler's bin, and curled here, and hadn't moved since. Purgis? He sat up a little, uncertain if he'd heard the voice or simply imagined it. He was not a particularly imaginative person, and the voice, a female, sounded very real. After a moment, he realized it was coming from the comlink mounted above his head. Frode reached up and keyed the mic. Purgis! Who are you? He asked aloud. How do you know my name? Kindra. How come I can hear you? The Force, Purgis. You're up there, I know. Frode listened to the voice. There was something unsettling about it, as if the speaker, Kindra, whoever that was trying very hard to sound calm and easygoing, as if nothing was wrong. Underneath it, though, he detected a strong undercurrent of, what? Fear? Terror? Where are you? He muttered. Hangar, the voice said. Get out! Get me out! What about those things? Aren't they still out there? No answer. He wondered if it was because something had happened to her that he couldn't hear her talking anymore. Kindra? Just open the hatch of the ship, Purgis. Open up and let me in. I'll be quick. We'll both fly out of here together. We can't stay here, but hurry. I'm right outside. I can't, he said. I took out the ship's flight computer. It can't navigate without it. We wouldn't make it three clicks in this weather. We'll crash right back into the snow. I'll help us. We'll get away somehow, I promise. Please, Purgis, just let me in. Please, hurry. Frode grimaced. One of the reasons he'd ventured all this way to the far end of the galaxy was his rotten luck with women. Specifically, his inability to deny them anything. Yet here he was again. Hating himself already, he stood up inside the storage bin, lifted off the steel plate, and crawled up into the main landing ramp. In truth, he wasn't sure why he was doing it. He knew it wasn't right. There was definitely something wrong about opening the hatchway. Yet the voice, the girl's pleas, her desperation motivated him forward, drew him along in a way that he couldn't quite comprehend. And maybe she could help get them out of here. Maybe. The Force, a faint voice of reason piped up deep inside him, from somewhere hopelessly deep within himself. She's using the Force on you to manipulate your actions. And although he knew it was true, he still couldn't quite seem to resist. He reached the main hatchway, placed his hand on the lever, and turned it, pushing it forward. Look, he started. I don't think this is... and stopped. Beyond the hatch, the hangar was completely dark. Frode stood clutching the bulkhead behind him, pupils dilating, trying to make out even the vaguest of shapes, but without success. It was as if whatever was out there had destroyed the lights and ripped out the power, burying the vast space around him in utter blackness. But he could hear them. Holding his breath, he could hear the sounds of many bodies rustling together, the faint, moist sound of their shoulders and arms and torsos packed together in the dark. They weren't breathing, but they were making hollow, rasping noises that could have been some obscene attempt at speech. Then, all around him, the lightsabers started coming on. They activated individually and in clusters, red humming spikes of light, dozens of them shooting upward, filling the air with a low oscillating hum that shook Frode's molars in the back of his mouth. His eyes began to adjust, and at length he began to make out the blades shining off the starved, dead faces of the students that held them upright, their blank expressions, the bleak and rapacious eyes that gaped back at him. Drool gleamed on their lips. Dried red gore encrusted their teeth and lips. No, Frode thought. Oh, no! Staring out at the things, he felt something inside him loosen, turn to liquid, and swirl away. Something both abstract and at the same time terribly visceral, like the blood supply to his heart. Everywhere he looked, more scarlet streaks continued to crosshatch on top of one another, springing up in all directions as if something were clawing its way out of the dark, and the dark was bleeding. And looking closer, he saw the girl. She was standing at the bottom of the gangway amid a shifting prison of red blades, surrounded by the rotting corpses of her classmates, their hands clutching her arms and legs, holding her captive. Lightsabers crisscrossed in front of her, hovered over her head, immobilizing her. One of the things had its open mouth pressed up against her bare throat. Another's teeth were bared and ready to attack a small, exposed part of her shoulder. A third and fourth stood waiting behind her, their jaws open so wide that it almost seemed like they could have devoured her entire head in one huge, all-consuming bite. "I did what you wanted," Kendra shouted at them. "He opened it. Now, let me go. Let me..." The things fell upon her, the red blades slashing her to pieces as they ripped her apart. Even from where Frode stood, the crunching noises were thick and juicy and glottal, like the sound of someone biting into a particularly ripe apple. Several of the corpses broke free from the group and started thundering up the gangway toward the open hatchway, just as Frode slammed it shut again. He decided he could fly the ship without the flight computer after all. Chapter 39. Down in It. Zoe awoke to a tight band of pain across her chest and shoulders, twisting in her joints like ground glass. When she tried to shift her position to alleviate the pain, she realized that she couldn't move at all. The pit where she lay was settled at the bottom of a deep shaft, its high onyx-colored walls shining up as far as the eye could see in some unfathomable expanse of glassy black. Her head spun. She realized that she had been tied down here, strapped to a large stone slab by wide leather bands and iron rings that crisscrossed her chest and looped over her wrists and ankles, pinning them in position. Torches burned on either side of her, rows of them in hundreds leading upward, flickering up over the walls, gleaming off tiny ornate lines of script and filigree that moved across it like rows of programmer's code. She breathed, coughed a little, and tried to summon moisture onto the back of her tongue. The air down here tasted metallic, dusty, and very old. It was like inhaling through a hole in some archaic stone tablet. Oily tallow from the torches dripped on the floor around her, and the greasy black smoke wafting up from their flames only made her throat feel more parched. From somewhere behind her, she heard movement, the scuff and rustle of footsteps, the soft clink of objects being arranged outside her peripheral vision. "Look up," Scabrous's voice croaked. Zoe turned and moved her neck, straining to tilt her head as much as the straps would allow. The Sith Lord was gazing down. The decay process had accelerated drastically since she'd last looked at him. The sickness had taken over his face completely now, remaking it into gelid, shapeless soup, from which two bloodshot eyes gleamed at her with terrible scrutiny. Gray strips of gristle quivered from the exposed bone of his skull, and when he spoke, she saw the tendons swing inside his throat. He was holding a sword. Not a lightsaber, but an actual Sith sword. Its shining blade seemed to have been forged from the same black durasteel as the walls around them, and stretched as long as Scabrous's arm. As the Sith Lord raised it up, Zoe realized that the designs from the walls of the pit had been echoed along the blade's entire length, great thorny rows of script and inscription gleaming in the torchlight. The resulting weapon seemed almost to blur and merge with its surroundings, its lethal edge shimmering and disappearing again as the Sith Lord swung it overhead. "This blade," Scabrous said, "belonged to Darth Dreer. It was forged exclusively for him, to ensure his immortality. So today, in accordance with his legacy, I will use it to slice out your living heart and devour it while you watch." Zoe tried to answer, with no idea of what she might say, but the knot in her throat blocked out all speech. Terror, bright and uncontrollable, had fastened itself over her conscious mind, and she could not stop staring at the sword. At this moment, nothing in her past, her training, or her aspirations for the future seemed as real to her as its blade. The inarguable geometric equation that connected its edge to her flesh. Hestizo. There was nothing she could do. The sword plunged down.
Chapter 40, Wet Work.
"There's one," Tulka said. "Behind that wall. See him?"
The HK pivoted unhesitatingly, firing two quick blasts at the open-mouthed Sith thing as it stalked